OU Israel presents
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky. This show is for Parshat Shmini / Parshat Parah. We are halfway done before this Shabbat with the four special Parshiot in Jerusalem. We've had the extra unique situation. Only exists in some years and only in Jerusalem of having five Shabbatot in a row of having more than one Torah being read. It started a couple of weeks back, March 1st on the secular calendar. I take that back. Rosh Chodesh Adar Sheni, which was March 8th. That was Parshat Shkalim, and we took out three Torahs for the regular Parshat HaShavua of Pekudei, for Parshat Shkalim, and before that for the Rosh Chodesh portion. Then a week later, March 15th, the 8th of Adar, we had Parshat Zohar, regular weekly Parsha of Vayikra, and the Maftir of Zohar. Then last week was a break, a hafsaka, from the sequence of the special Parshiot all over the world. But in Jerusalem, we ended up with another double Torah Shabbat, namely Shabbat Purim. Very unusual even for Yerushalayim and only a curiosity outside of Jerusalem. It occurs, as I mentioned in previous shows, with a frequency of 11.5%. It's not the most common thing. It goes hand in hand, by the way, with the Seder on Motzoi Shabbat or Erev Pesach being on Shabbat. And that's coming up, Emir Tzashem, in 4 weeks. But you have Shabbat Purim, regular Parshat HaShavua this year was Tzav, and the Maftir was the portion that is read on Purim morning, and a special Haftarah, which happened to have been the previous Shabbat's Haftarah of Zachor. One way or the other, that gives us 1, 2, 3 Shabbatot in a row in Jerusalem, with 3 or 2 Torah scrolls being read from. And this coming Shabbat, March 29th, the 22nd of the second Adar, is Parshat Shmini, the regular weekly portion, and Parshat Parah, the special portion. Next week, Emir Tzashem, which will be April 5th, the 29th of Adar Sheni, you have regular weekly portion Tazria and the Maftir of Parshat HaChodesh. It happens also to be the day before Rosh Chodesh, Mochar Chodesh, but we'll talk more about that in Mir Tzashem next week. So, recording and first broadcast is Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 27th of March, the 20th of Adar Sheni, or Adar Bet, as it is sometimes called, or even V'Adar, Adar and Adar. And we are winding down the merry month of March. I know that's usually the merry month of May, but we'll apply it to March this time. And winding down not as quickly with the second Adar, but once Purim passes, we already sense the upcoming Pesach, which means the month of Adar rolls into Nisan and the holiday season is well upon us. Psalm 130, Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Shir HaMa'alot Mima'amakim Karaticha Adonai, Adonai Shima V'Koli Tehiyena Aznecha Kashuvot L'Kol Tachanunai, Im Avonot Tishmor Ya Adonai Miya Amod, Ki Imacha Hasalicha L'Ma'an Tivarei, Ki Viti Adonai Kiveta Nafshi V'Lidvaro Hocholti, Nafshi L'Adonai Mi Shomerim L'Boker Shomerim L'Boker, Yachel Yisrael el Adonai ki im Adonai ha chesed v'harbe imo fedut. v'hu yifda et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanatunim batzara uvashivya ha'omedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha ha'makom yirachem aleihem v'yotziyem mitzara lirvacha ומאפלה לאורה ומשיבוד לגאולה, השתה בעגלה ובזמן קריב, ונאמר אמן. Before we get into Parshat HaShavua and Parshat Porah and the calendar and the shiur I gave to the folders last night about the combination this year, specifically of Parshat Shmini and Parshat Porah, I wanted to indulge in a personal anecdote. Today being the 20th of Adar makes yesterday the 19th of Adar. My mother, Aleha Shalom, passed away 10 years ago on the 19th of Adar. It was in a year that had only one Adar. The Ashkenazi custom is to observe the Yahrzeit in the first Adar and then again in the second one. The Sephardi custom is to observe only the second one. And it seems, according to the Ashkenazi community, that it's really the first one that is the Yahrzeit, although we're not sure, and the second one gets observed out of safek, doubt. As it turns out, my brothers and I decided to coordinate, and we observe both Yahrzeits completely, which means lighting a memorial candle and means being the shaliach tzibur at the services and the saying of Kaddish and the getting of maftir if we could swing it on the Shabbat before the Yahrzeit and including fasting on the Yahrzeit, which is a custom among some but not all Ashkenazi Jews. I once discussed it with someone of Hasidic leaning, and he sort of smiled and said, the Hasidic way of observing a Yahrzeit is with cake and whiskey and eating rather than fasting, which is so in some communities. But my brothers and I do fast, as I did yesterday. And we also visit the cemetery in both Adars. We sort of feel it's an ironic compensation for the fact that my father, Zichrono Livracha, passed away on Chanukah, and on Chanukah you don't fast on a Yahrzeit. Nobody does. And therefore, we owe a few fasts, and then every couple of years or 3 years, however often the second Adar pops around, we decided to hold them both, including fasting. But that's not why I bring it up. I bring it up because 10 years ago, a little bit more than 10 years ago, is when Torah Tidbits Audio started on Arut Sheva. At the time, it was broadcast on the radio, not yet on the internet. That came later. There was an overlap period where it was still on the radio and it was also being broadcast on the internet. And then when Arut Sheva went off the air at the government's whim, it remained on the internet all of these years since, and someday they'll get back on the air. But at the time, 10 years ago plus, it was a radio show as part of the regular programming of Arut Sheva. At the early years, it was a Wednesday night show, and then it shifted to its more common time slot of Thursday evening. But in the very early days, which includes the Monday before my mother passed away on a Tuesday morning, so we're talking 10 years ago this week, the technician from Arut Sheva used to come into Yerushalayim, sit across the desk from me in my office, and record the show. I would then give music requests, and they would put it in at the station and put the show together and then broadcast it. Now, the broadcasting in those days was done from a ship at sea because it was not legal to broadcast from the boundaries of Israel, and this ship was anchored 12 miles out in international waters and would broadcast to boosters in Israel, which would then put it out over the airwaves, and thereby being within the bounds of legality. All right, so that's the story. So what happens is he comes on Monday on, I'm sorry, he came on Tuesday morning. I'm getting the story a little confused, but I'm not going to go back and change it. You'll take it with my correction. Monday, all day Monday, I was with my mother in the hospital, Shaarei Tzedek Hospital in Jerusalem, and she was failing very seriously at that time. I spent Monday night at her bedside, and Monday morning at 9 o'clock, my brother and sister-in-law relieved me at the hospital, and I came to the Israel Center, where I was to meet the technician to record my show. I made the recording Tuesday morning. When I finished recording, I get handed a note, call my brother at the hospital urgently, and they did not interrupt the recording, and I spoke to my brother, and he told me that my mother had passed away. So, of course, I went over to the hospital, and in the course of all of the preparation for the funeral that afternoon, I also spoke to Baruch Gordon, head of the English department at Arut Sheva, and told him that my mother had passed away and that I'll be sitting Shiva. And my suggestion was that the show be broadcast on Wednesday night anyway, and it be introduced by him or an announcer saying that Phil is now sitting Shiva, but he recorded this before his mother passed away, etc., etc. Almost in line with the show must go on philosophy. It turns out that on the day of the funeral and the following day, there was a freak snowstorm, heavy snowstorm. We're talking after Purim, which is extremely rare in Israel. And the sea was so choppy that the boat ship was called back to port on Wednesday rather than being battered out at sea. And that night, uncharacteristic of Arut Sheva, there were no transmission of any shows because the sea had to come in. So the show that had been recorded never was aired. I happen to have a tape of it someplace. But the irony struck me so strongly that I went in with the philosophy of the show must go on. And God apparently had a different idea, and he says to me, you know, the show doesn't have to go on. Your mother passed away, you are an Avel, you are sitting Shiva, and your show doesn't have to go on. And it didn't. Through the vehicle of nature, which is at God's disposal to do with what as he wants. So I took it as a personal message, and all these 10 years I periodically think about it. And I wanted to share it with you. Again, I'm sure I've done it in the past sometimes, but somehow 10th anniversary of the death, 10th Yahrzeit, has you waxing nostalgic more than other numbered Yahrzeits. So that's the story. Of course, I could say, and I should say, and I often think about it, this show and all my shows of Torah Tidbits audio and every week's written Torah Tidbits hard copy and electronic versions on the internet and in email are all in memory of my parents, Aleihem HaShalom. On some level, on very significant level, I am what I am because of them. They did not just ship me off to school and let tuition pay for my schooling, but I attribute a tremendous amount of my education and the person I am and became to both of my parents, and therefore it's obvious and clear to me to say I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now had it not been for my parents and their influence. And I will be eternally grateful to them, and any way that I could honor their memory, I am glad to do. So this show, specifically because yesterday was my mother's Yahrzeit, is in memory of Rachel Bat Reb Yecheskel, Aleha HaShalom, and I hope in some way she's proud of her children and grandchildren and the great-grandchildren she's never seen. the shiur that I recorded yesterday to the folders yesterday evening will take up much of the second half of the show, so I'm going to use the remaining time on this half to talk a little bit about the other content of Parshat HaShavua, Parshat Shmini. It is noteworthy that the book of Vayikra is thought of as Torat Kohanim, the Torah of the Kohen, because it discusses the sacrifices and other functions in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple, or the temporary version of the temple called the Mishkan, or the Tabernacles. And you see a sequence that comes out very strongly in the first 2.5 sedras of the book of Vayikra, the book of Leviticus, where Vayikra and Tzav and the beginning of Shmini are all about korbanot, sacrifices in the temple, in other words, sacred use of animals. And only in the second half of Shmini do we have, as if God is saying, now that it is clear that your primary use of the animals which I created in this world and gave you dominance over is in the service of God in the temple, you now have my permission to eat meat of animals. Not all animals, certain animals. And that's exactly what we find in the second half of this week's Torah reading. We have, these are the mammals among the domesticated and non-domesticated mammals that you are allowed to eat, those that have split hoof and chew their cud, and these are the ones you're not allowed to eat, and the Torah gives examples, the gamal, the camel, the shafan, and the arnevet, and the chazir, the pig. I purposely avoided translating Shafan and Arnevet. It's an interesting debate as to what the Torah meant when it used those two terms. I will say in general that one has to be very cautious not to confuse biblical Hebrew with modern Hebrew. Of course, many, many words are the same and many rules of grammar are the same, but they're not identical. And when Hebrew had gone through such a long period of time of not being a spoken language, we lost the meaning of certain words in the Torah, the ones that were not in everyday use. And by the way, if you hear this again on the recording that I made yesterday, it's unintentional. I don't think it's there because I spoke about something else, but I guess I'm reaching that age where if I spoke on Tuesday morning, which I did, and again on Wednesday afternoon, and on Monday afternoon as well, then sometimes they mix up in my mind when I said what. I don't think I said this on the recording that you'll be listening to. And biblical Hebrew was used as a basis to attach words to certain objects and ideas in modern Hebrew, and they don't necessarily correlate. The word nesher in modern Hebrew is an eagle. But the biblical nesher, although some will translate it as eagle, others lean in the direction of the griffin vulture, which is a different bird and has different characteristics, and is more closely identified with the biblical and Talmudic description of the Nesher. Shafan is used in modern Hebrew for a rabbit, a bunny rabbit, or as my granddaughter says, a runny babbit. And the biblical Shafan is not a rabbit, according to most authorities, but rather is a hyrax, or a coney, or a rock badger, or one of those. And there are complications in all of this. Sometimes there's a halachic ramification, sometimes it's just a semantic difference, but these things should be kept in mind. In any event, after the Torah discusses the mammals, split hoof, chew the cud, it does not give names of animals which are considered kosher. That is found in Parshat Re'eh when this topic comes up again. And there they mention the three types of domesticated animals, the cow family, the sheep family, and the goat family. And by the way, there is a real discussion today among halachic authorities as to which members of the cow family we can assume are kosher like a cow, and which we say, well, look, scientifically these may be classified as bovine, but that does not necessarily mean they're included in permission to eat the way it's described in the Torah. So the issues that have been brought up in recent times apply to buffalo and apply to water buffalo and apply to the zebu, Z-E-B-U, which is found in South America and is crossbred with cattle. And there has been a question asked. I think the answer came through that we're definitely dealing with kosher animals without a problem here. But it's not a question that should not be asked. I don't know if that came out right. It's a question that must be asked, and answers have to be given. We cannot, or should not, better, suffice to say, my great-grandfather ate beef, and he knew that there was also sheep and goat that was kosher, and he ate chicken, but he also knew maybe one or two other birds were kosher. We need to define what's a kosher animal, what's a kosher fish, what's a kosher bird, and what's a kosher insect, which we have a little more difficulty doing. But in light of modern experience, it's not that we're changing any of the rules of kashrut. It's just no one in the past had to cope with the issue, is a giraffe a kosher animal? A giraffe happens to be an animal, a mammal, that chews its cud, that has a split hoof. These were inspected very close at hand. I know someone who attended an autopsy of a baby giraffe from the zoo that had died, and the group of people that were examining it took a careful look at the stomach to see if it matches the stomach of a ruminant animal and qualifies as a legitimate kosher cud chewer in addition to a split hoof. Things are not always crystal clear, but even when they're not, we have a system of rabbinic authority with asking a shaila and getting an official response, and knowing what to eat and what to do and what not to do and what not to eat, etc., etc. Hold that thought. We'll be right back.
I'm Rod Sterling. You're listening to
Torah Tidbits Audio.
Rest your eyes.
And listen to more of Torah Tidbits Audio for Parshat Shmini and Parshat Parah. It's not exactly like working together with Rod Serling, but it feels like a collaborative effort by using that intro. Let me just finish up what I was talking about, kosher, non-kosher. When you go to the biblical zoo here, this was one of the thrills, I saw an adult goat sitting, relaxing, in such a way that his front feet, his whatever they call them, paws, front feet, forelimbs, were pointing outward on the ground as if to say, here, take a look. See, they have split hoofs. And then I watched and I see this lump come through under the skin but up the goat's throat, pop into his mouth, and he starts chewing, not in the way that a goat would chew grass or hay, or whatever else goats eat, but a side-to-side motion of chewing, which is the chewing of a cud. And it was a very exciting thing to see, because he was proclaiming, I am a kosher mammal. But it's not always that easy. Take fish, for example. Fish requires scales and fins in order to qualify as kosher. There are many, many kosher fish, without a doubt. There are many non-kosher fish. I think there are more species of kosher than non-kosher, by the way. But you then have fish that lose their scales from their young years to their adult form. There are fish that lose their scales when taken out of the water. There are fish that have scales that don't exactly look like the scales we're used to seeing in the kosher fish that we've been eating. And then you have fish that have been part of human diet and Jewish diet for centuries, and these are well known to be kosher. Nobody questions the kashrut of a salmon. Nobody questions the kashrut of many, many fish that are part of our tradition. But then you have fish that have not been traditionally included in the diet of the Jew, the kosher Jew, and that does not automatically mean that the fish is not kosher. Most recent example I could think of is the blue marlin, which is a game fish, which has fins, of course, and scales. But the scales are not like the typical coat of mail looking easily scraped off scales. It has some type of scale, which biologically is one thing and halachically could be something else. And, in fact, I have it on first-hand testimony that chunks of the blue marlin with its skin were shown to various halachic authorities in Israel, and after examination and study, they proclaimed that it is a kosher fish. But you still have some who will probably say it's not a kosher fish. When it comes to birds, the situation is even more difficult. Because unlike mammals with split hoof and chewing the cud, and unlike fish with scales and fins, the issue with birds is a list of 20 types of birds that the Torah says these are not kosher, and all the rest of the birds are. And here you have a tremendous impact on what is called masoret, or tradition. Is a peacock kosher? I spoke to Ari Zivotofsky, who is an expert in this area, and he said that we highly suspect that a peacock is a kosher bird, that we are looking for, actively looking, not I and not you, the listener necessarily, but some people are looking for elderly ritual slaughterers, shochatim, from different communities, who perhaps learned their tradition from their father and grandfather, so we can date it back, and we're looking for some evidence that a peacock was among birds that were slaughtered for ritual purposes, meaning kosher slaughter for food. And we've got various quail and various pheasant that are clearly not only kosher but have this masoret attached to them already, and partridges and various and sundry other birds aside from the chicken and duck and goose that we know is part of Jewish diet through the centuries. And even turkey is an interesting thing, and guinea fowl is an interesting thing, where traditions are being collected, meaning if you have a Moroccan shochet in his late 80s, early 90s, who said, when I was just learning shechita, my father, who was a shochet, told me that this bird, and he points to a picture or an actual sample of the bird, is kosher, then we accept that. Etc., etc. All right, enough on this now. Let me now ask you to listen to the topic of Parshat Parah, especially this year when it is connected to Parshat Shmini. It's always interesting when you take a look at the special Parsha and the weekly Parsha that it's attached to. They're not always the same. But there's a limited range. In other words, shkalim, sometimes paired with this, and sometimes paired with that, and once in a while with that. Two or three or four sedras basically cover for each special.
But each time you look at it as, this is what I have to say this year. Right now, Parshat Porah is this coming Shabbat. The weekly portion is Shmini. So you're always curious to see what does Shmini say, what does Porah say, and what you could say about it, even though next year it's not going to work because Porah will be a different seder. And that's, of course, a result of the one Adar, two Adars, and the slight shift depending on what day of the week Rosh Hashanah is. In any event, Parshat Shmini describes the opening functioning of the Mishkan. This is it. We went through the Sedras of the Asuli Mikdash, make me a sanctuary, and all of the collection of materials in the building, and then even the 1 week of inaugural activity in the Mikdash. Now, finally, it's Yom HaShmini, the eighth day, following the seven unusual days of inauguration, and now the Mikdash is starting its career, so to speak. The very, very first offering, sacrifice, in the Mikdash, which was not a regular sacrifice, but it was a one-time shot, was a special offering by the Kohen Gadol in atonement for himself before he brings Korbanot on behalf of the people. And what is the animal that is brought? An Egel Ben Shana, a calf. Calves were unusual to be brought as Korbanot. Much more common are the par, the older male cow, the ayel, an adult male sheep, the keves, a lamb, which in modern Hebrew is teleh, but the word keves in the Torah often refers to keves ben shana. Whenever the Torah refers to an animal of ben shana, it means within its first year. It does not mean a one-year-old, it means within its first year. And goat. But this one stands out. The first korban, Aharon brings an egel, and all of a sudden you automatically associate with Egel HaZahav, and all the Mefarshim jump and say the same thing, that this was a kapara for the Egel Asher Asa Aharon. However you want to describe the Egel HaZahav, the most irksome feature of it is when the Torah refers to it as the Egel that Aharon made, even though he is not held responsible for the sin of the golden calf. There's always that speculation as to whether he could have done, should have done something different that would have avoided the problem. And he carries that baggage, not just personally, but the Kohen Gadol carries that baggage. That's why in the Maftir, now I'm jumping from Shmini to its Maftir this week of Parah, it's Moshe telling Elazar to take the Parah Aduma and prepare it. Who is Elazar? He is the Sagan Kohen Gadol, the vice Kohen Gadol, the assistant Kohen Gadol to his father Aharon. Aharon's death is recorded later in Parshat Chukat, but now Aharon is there. He doesn't get the command to do Parah Aduma, his son does. And that's considered very symbolic because the Parah, the cow, is the mother of the calf and comes as an atonement for Egel HaZahav. And it is Aharon's son who is called upon to prepare the Parah Aduma as atonement for, perhaps, his father. Now, in halacha of Parah Aduma, any Kohen was qualified to do it, including the Kohen Gadol, and including anyone not the Sagan Kohen Gadol. But the first command went to Elazar, and that's considered symbolic as well. So what you have in the Sedra then is, at the beginning of the regular weekly portion, Aaron is commanded to take an egel as a chatat, a sin offering. And in the maftir of Parshat Parah, Elazar is commanded to take the Parah Aduma and prepare it for its function. And it is clear that the choice of the Torah, of God, so to speak, not so to speak, of God, in the Parah Aduma is seen as an atonement for Chet HaEgel. Which leads to my favorite question in this area. First, recognizing that Parah Aduma is considered the quintessential chok. It is, don't start giving reasons and don't start understanding and don't start be logical. It defies all of that. And yet, as gingerly as certain sources tiptoe about hesitating to explain that which Shlomo HaMelech in his great wisdom said, I've achieved understanding of everything in all of the mitzvot, except Parah Aduma remains remote to me. And notwithstanding that, people still try to explain it. Now, if you explain Parah Aduma as a kapara, an atonement for Chet HaEgel, then I have always found one nagging question. When you look at the Egel at the beginning of the Seder of Shmini that's brought as a Korban Chatat, the word Kapara, atonement, fits. When you're talking about the Egel, the Parah Aduma being a Kapara, you say, well, wait a minute. The Parah Aduma is not a Korban. It's not a sacrifice. It was not prepared in the Beit HaMikdash area, purposely removed from the Beit HaMikdash. It certainly has Korban-like rules, but let's look at the main function of the Parah Aduma. It was not lechaper, to atone, it was letaher, to purify. To purify only one who contracted tuma, ritual impurity, to contact with a dead body. No other kind of tuma is affected by the potion of the Parah Aduma or requires the potion of the Parah Aduma. It's unique to tumat mate. And being tame, to contact to a dead body, is not a sin. So it almost loses it sort of slips by you when you say Parah Aduma kapara for Chet HaEgel, atonement for the golden calf. But then you say, it seems a little bit out of step, meaning, I understand, a korban, a sacrifice brought on the altar, the atoning altar, that fits. But that which is burned and its ashes are mixed with water from a live spring and a few other things that went into the burning of the Parah Aduma, and its potion is now used to purify those that become tameh, where do we see the kapara angle to it? In other words, how does it fit to ultimately serve that function as the kapara for Chet HaEgel? And I understand it as follows. Tumat mate, I've said this before, but it's good to review it each year, which is why we have a Parshat Parah each year. Tumat mate, ritual impurity to contact to a dead body, is not a purely logical foregone conclusion had it not been the rule of the Torah. In other words, why is a dead body avi avot hatuma? It is the, to use the English expression, the mother of all impurity, even though the Hebrew is the father of all purity, the father of the father, avi avot hatuma, the grandfather of tuma. Why? What makes a dead body tame? What makes a carcasses of animals are also the tame, but not on that same high level of a human body. But the question is, you have to explore what does tuma mean in the first place. But even if, whatever you want to say about it, why is a dead body so much a source of tuma? And the answer is, simply put, sin. Chet. Watch it like this. At a person's birth, or even before birth, a soul, which is purely spiritual, which is referred to as chelek elokut, some part of the divine essence, enters a body which it will share for the rest of the person's life, to be separated only upon the person's death. The body is the receptacle of the soul. The guf is the kli for the neshama. The body, really meaning the whole person, which includes his neshama, has a very sacred trust in life, and that is to do mitzvot, to be a good person, to rise in kedusha, and in looking at it this way, to be worthy of being the receptacle of the neshama. The famous analogy to the king whose daughter wanted to marry a peasant, and the king calls the peasant in and he says, look, I can't object anymore because my daughter is insistent on marrying you, but I will tell you that you have got to treat her like a princess, not like a peasant's wife. And that God says to the goof, you are getting the neshama as your life's part. You better treat that neshama the way it should be treated. And every sin that a person does is a mistreatment, an abuse of his neshama. So what should have been is that people, Jews, will go through life doing mitzvot and being kodesh, kadosh, and whatever else they're supposed to do, and never sinning because they're not allowed to sin. It's a sin to sin. So what are they doing? Every time they sin, it's a mark against their goof. If there would be no sinning, then the body would merely be the receptacle of the neshama, and when the neshama is taken out, the body would not be tame necessarily. It would be finished with its use in life, and it would be properly taken care of in burial, which it is anyway, but it would not necessarily transmit tuma, except in contrast to the neshama that's leaving it. The neshama is tohora. The goof, if it behaved the way it was supposed to be throughout its life, would be fine, whatever that fine means. I don't know if you could say it's tohora, but you wouldn't necessarily say it's tamea. But the fact is, Ein Adam Asher Lo Yecheta. There is no such thing as a person who doesn't sin. And therefore, to illustrate in grand form the contrast between the goof and the neshama, and even when you recognize that everybody sins, it's still now a challenge to minimize the amount of sinning. A person can't say, hey, I have a goof. There is no such thing as a person that doesn't sin, so I can do whatever I want. It doesn't work like that. Every challenge, every temptation, a person is challenged, in essence, to say, treat your neshama properly, or not. And because people sin, there is this concept of tuma. Now, the first major communal sin of Klal Yisrael, after the purification of Matan Torah, they had gone from low level of Tumah in Mitzrayim, in a building up process to be worthy of standing at Sinai to hear God's voice and to witness divine revelation and receive the Torah. 40 days later, they blew it with Chet HaEgel. It's as if Chet HaEgel redefined the goof. Because before Chet HaEgel, the body of the Jew holding the Jewish soul was pure. And Chet HaEgel represented the realization or the reality, I guess those are related words, the reality of human beings and Jews also as being prone and tempted to sin. And as a reminder of that, the human body in the absence of its neshama is considered halachically to be the ultimate source of tuma, and the Pora Adu Duma process, even though it's not a sin to be Tameh, it's sometimes a big mitzvah. The Chevra Kadisha, the burial society, are Tameh all the time, performing these wonderful mitzvot, Chesed Shel Emet. Yet that reminder of Chaito Egel is let's call it the perpetuation of Chaito Egel, or the result of Chaito Egel, is the halachic status of Tuma of a dead body, and therefore the Pora Aduma's ashes, the potion that's made from it, becomes the atonement. It becomes primarily the purification of the Tuma, but that now has another definition or another function as being an atonement for Chaito Egel. In which case, at least in my understanding, and I don't know if I was able to convey it, that out of synchronization that I felt at the beginning is now put back into step. I now don't ask that question, except when I'm teaching it. I don't ask it in myself of, well, wait a minute, it's not a sin to become Tameh. No, but it's sin that created the Tuma. And therefore, the vehicle of purification is considered an atonement for Chaito Egel.
On that note, let me wish you a Shabbat Shalom and Lehishtameah.